Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Onofuaken.
This week, Sony ditches the PC market, Amazon's ready to play games, GoPro goes for IPO, Google shows their true colors, and Flappy Bird gets its wings clipped, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in our show notes. And feel free to leave us a review on iTunes as well. You can join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. Dwayne, you just dropped in, so I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to prep you on this. I'm going to start with Tosin. Tosin, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're playing with this week?
So I've actually been playing, I think this was the first title that I ever kickstarted, and it's a game called Broken Age by the company called Double Fine. So have you guys heard of Broken Age?
No.
Yeah. Well, I heard of Broken Age when they were in their Kickstarter, and I've definitely heard of Double Fine because the guy who's in Double Fine, I'm drawing a blank on his name. It's Tim something or other.
Tim Schafer.
Yeah, he's got this this great legacy of games. He did Psychonauts.
Yep, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Grim Fandango.
Yeah.
And he's worked on a bunch of other as part of Lucas.
Is the Grim Fandango guy startup?
Yep.
I remember watching the Kickstarter for it. I just don't remember. Okay, who cares about that? Whatever. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the first really popular Kickstarters from a well-known company. And I believe they made, I think according to Wikipedia, they made over $3.45 million within the first month. So a huge crowdfunding success. Well, that project is now officially out, or at least the first half of it. And what it is, it's a graphical point-and-click adventure game. So similar to those old-school games that some of us, at least I grew up with.
Sure.
I believe you two did as well. And so I started playing it, and so far it really has this sort of classic charm to it. It mm-hmm. has that the comedic beats that you find from the titles of that era, spruced up with sharper graphics, and it's just so far I'm having a pretty good time, and it's fairly relaxed, and you know it's one of those titles that I'm actually enjoying coming home after a busy day of work, after working out, just sitting there and you know solving puzzles. And so far I'm really enjoying it and hope to continue. I definitely would recommend that people check it out. It's currently available on Steam. I think currently it's probably around $25, but it will get cheaper. As well as if you did back it, I think today released a DRM-free versions of that title from the backing location. So
DRM-free? Serious?
Yes. Yes,
fucking
that was one of the things they promised.
I'm going to have to demo that for you.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to pick that up on Steam next time there's a sale. I've got it on my wish list.
There you go. You know what I wish with wish lists? Here's the thing. I wish wish lists, at least on Amazon, which is like king of wish lists for me,
uh-huh.
that once you bought something, it didn't disappear. I know that it goes to your stuff you ordered list, but I'd like a wish list or a list of like, things that were on your wish list that are no longer on your wish list. Because that would help me better keep track than having to go. Because when you go through the order thing on Amazon, like you search down an order, it's like a whole lot of work. Like, oh, which order was it? It's not tied to the actual item. It's an order number based on time, open and recent, last 6 months, yada, yada, yada. Just give me a list of the shit that was on my wish list that I already bought. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't feel like you have a need for it to go away from your wish list once you're once you acquired it?
I wanted
it
to move to a separate list that is in, among the wish lists.
Uh-huh.
That is like purchased, wish fulfilled. I don't know.
That's what a wish fulfilled list. That's basically what you're talking about there.
Yes. I want to know what was on my wish list that got bought. Uh-huh. I have. That's key. One of my friends snuck on. So I guess I had like back in the day, I had a generic, your default Amazon wish list. And I don't know how my buddy figured out which one it was. My birthday came around and I got this Dalek alarm clock. She looked like Dalek from like the seventh series of Doctor Who. Fifth series Doctor Who, the one where he's in the like World War II and Winston Churchill and the new Dalek
show. Oh, I love that episode.
Yeah, so like I got like a white Dalek alarm clock. Uh-huh. And I'm like, how did he know? And I realized that like my wish list was public and he like figured it all out. Since then, I've gotten a little smarter. But I have like multiple wish lists now. I've got one for like garage workshop, one for bath, one for kitchen, one for a living room, all that stuff, right? So it's easier to keep track if I'm not just looking at my order numbers. Anyway, mm-hmm. That's an aside. I've got something I've been playing with aside from wish lists as well. And mine is also a backed startup. The startup in this case is called Black Sumac, and they make a device called the Piper. Sure. They were on Indiegogo. They weren't on Kickstarter.
Talked about the Piper here and there, but not really in depth.
Right. So the Piper, when you look at the device itself, it looks like a random standalone camera. But what it is, it's smart home or connected home automation. And a Z-Wave controller. So I spent the money for the Z-Wave combo pack. And you get this device that looks like a camera, like a kind of like a, it's on a little stand. It has a camera. It looks like something Apple would put together, really.
Yeah.
And it has a motion detector on it. And you have a couple modes, away mode, stay mode, no mode, and vacation mode. No mode is basically off. And so you set this thing up. I have it in the corner of my room. It connects to your Wi-Fi. It's got this crazy fisheye lens that gives you a great view of the whole room. If you're on an iPhone, the first thing you realize is that you can pan and zoom unless you want to zoom out, and then you see like the whole fisheye. But we got it basically because it has all these weird features, like great features, really. You can hear what's going on in the room. It's got a microphone. You can talk to the room. It's got a speaker. Mm-hmm. It's got a humidity sensor, a temperature sensor, ambient light sensor, obviously it's a camera, motion detection, all these things. So you set it up to let you know when things change in your house.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Z-Wave component is that it's also a Z-Wave controller, and it works with a lot of Z-Wave components. So the pack that I bought comes with a wall plug-in, which I use for a lamp. Basically, when the light is low, when the sun goes down, this lamp turns on. It stays on for like 8 hours, and then it turns itself off. There's that, and then there's also like, you know, you can set it up so that if a door opens, it came with two door sensors, door window sensors. Door window opens, you know, and it sends you a push notification. So it has a security component. The thing about it is that it's not going to go and call the cops. It's not going to go and call ADT or anything. It's going to like send you a text message and you've got to do the rest. Or like a push notification. It'll send you one based on temperature, humidity. One thing I haven't been able to do is I wanted to set up my humidifiers in the house so that when the humidity dropped beneath a certain level, let's say 25%, it would turn on the humidifiers until it discovered that it was at 25% again. It allows you to set triggers based on temperature, light, and time, but it doesn't allow you to set triggers based on humidity yet. Small price to pay, but overall it's great. I use it to watch my cats because I'm an internet video goofball. And, you know, it's great to be able to just kind of see how your apartment is. If you have an open floor plan like I do, you get to see the majority of the space you live in pretty simply. So for the money, it's pretty tight. There are a couple other options out there. Before Z-Wave controller that can control everything from locks to lights to, you know, other stuff. It's really great. I think it's definitely worth the money. If you're more into specific Super Control, you're going to look at something like Revolve. That's Revolve without an E at the end. That does like Insteon controls, U-Wave control, and some other stuff like that. But I mean, the pipe was really tight, and it brings a level of home automation that I didn't have before. Like, I can literally have it set up so that a space heater goes on if I'm worried that my pipes are going to freeze. And that's huge, because unlike so many other things, the triggers can be based on temperature as well as ambient light as well as, you know, whatever. And you can set up modes. So when I'm on vacation, it's a whole different mode than if I'm in the house. And in the house, you still want to know what happens if someone's going to try to open the door while you're sleeping or whatever. So it's a pretty nice connected system for the current age. And, you know, Indiegogo, you know, you can't beat it.
Sure. Sure. What one of the things I think is interesting about Indiegogo as compared to Kickstarter is that, from what I understand, you know, if a project is not fully funded on Kickstarter, you are not charged basically the project does not get the money that you have pledged. Indiegogo, they do get the money that you pledge, even if they don't get fully funded.
I think it's a little different than that. Indiegogo has two ways of funding. One of them, I think Kickstarter might have two ways, or Indiegogo has two ways. Indiegogo has a way where that it didn't get funded, your money's not going to be taken. And then, like, it did get funded. There's like a fixed rate and a kind of like ongoing kind of thing.
Sure.
So I'm not sure which one has it, but it's definitely a different vibe. And to me, that's the big thing. Mm-hmm. Indiegogo has far more Skylarky projects on it than Kickstarter does. But at the same time, you know, like those Skylarky projects like Piper, they're on a whole new level than what you're used to. A big thing for me, though, is that Indiegogo doesn't have an app. It's just the web page. Mm-hmm. And if you're hanging out on mobile, that's a whole different like world.
Like we talked about Indiegogo. We talked about Indiegogo before because they were the ones that was where the project was to fund a phone based on, I think it was Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, a Linux phone. I think it was Ubuntu, right? The Ubuntu phone was that project was started on Indiegogo.
Oh, okay.
All right, let's get into some headlines here. And this is an older headline. This is something that popped up within the course of last week's show, but we didn't report on it because it was kind of, I don't think it had been finalized, but now it is final. Sony last week said it was going to sell its PC business and the VAIO brand to Japan Industrial Partners, JIP, with the final deal set to be done by the end of March 2014. Sony says it was a drop in demand for its PCs that spurred this change. Their CEO, Kaz Hirai, said it was an agonizing decision and that it was a very Sony brand and it stirred up the PC market. Sony says no longer designing and developing PC products while manufacturing and sales will wrap up after the company's final VAIO range goes on sale. And it's decided to focus on post-PC products, which is smartphones and tablets.
Yeah,
Post-PC era?
As in the post-PC era, yes.
Sony is interesting because for a long time, Sony and Apple had conversations about bringing OS X over to the VAIO machines because they shared a lot on the design philosophy. Mm-hmm. Eventually, Apple just went for the x86 PC chips. But the VAIO, while expensive, was as close to the Mac experience that you could get on Windows for some time. And it's clear that Apple's gone gangbusters on their desktop PC market, their laptops.
Yeah.
And that's a big piece of what's gone on here. So it's interesting to see that Sony's selling it. Now, let's face it. It's a Japanese company selling their product
to another Japanese company, right?
Yeah.
It's not as big as, say, the news that Lenovo is buying IBM's server business.
Right. Or even Motorola Mobility, for that matter.
And, like, so Lenovo and like, you know, Congress is freaked out about this, the fact that Lenovo's buying these two huge things.
Yeah.
Motorola Mobility, which is what Google needed to sell in order to afford Nest, really. And IBM's, you know, small server business. So that, to me, is actually a bigger deal because it's China emerging, right? It's China continuing to move into the space that the U.S. had in the 1940s and 50s where we made things as IBM moves to, like, a consulting services company. So, but yeah, this is like a Japanese company selling its product to another Japanese company. You know, when Sony sells its TV business, when it sells its embedded devices, then I feel like we should begin to think about a paradigm shift. But the PC was kind of, an added value and not really a super amazing, well, it wasn't one of those like marquee Sony things like the Walkman or the TV or whatever.
The PC was actually pretty good. I had a Sony Vaio at a point, and I really liked it. It was quite sleek for.
Was sleek. It just wasn't the marquee product that Sony was making. I felt like it was always an afterthought. Like, you think about Sony, you think about gorgeous television sets. You think about Walkmans or mini disc players or anything they really innovated on. I think they did the PC right. I think they did fine by it, even though it was expensive. But it wasn't a product category that really allowed them to be known for that. It was a product category that they joined, not that they invented. Like, yeah, they invented the TV. That's all
true. I mean, but I also do really, you know, and granted, I do work for a cloud company, so I'll keep that in mind. But I do think, you know, that sort of concept of moving away from the PC and being more mobile, in terms of, you know, concentrating on handheld and tablets is definitely a direction to be in, because we saw similar things. You know, IBM did this in the IBM did this in the 90s, right, when they got rid of their
PC product to Lenovo, and now they're selling their Blade product to Lenovo.
Right. So I think both organizations are sort of sensing the direction, because, as you can tell, the selling of PCs and laptops have gone down over the past years. And I don't know if it's – I think, you know, it's not the sort of thing where it's going to drop off the face of the planet. But It's not really a market where you're – a market where you think you're going to get long-term gains. So best to focus that energy elsewhere if you, you know, have that sort of diversification.
Yeah, there's no doubt that – basically embedded devices are the place where we're seeing the most growth. There's no doubt there. So it's making a decision. I mean, their biggest product is an embedded device. That's the PlayStation 3.
Right? Sure.
That's really what they have to focus on. And if they can sell this off and make a nice write down and keep profitability intact.
I can't imagine Sony ever selling their television unit.
The televisions are rumored to not make them money.
Really?
But they are a marquee. Yeah, they don't make a lot
of money. They're, in my mind, they're mainly what they're known for.
I think the PlayStation is where the current generation of purchasers, upcoming purchasers, know them for.
Yeah.
The PlayStation accounts for the majority of their income. The PlayStation is where they're making their annual income. But the TV is a fantastic piece of hardware because you can use much of the PlayStation's software in order to get, you know, these web-connected services involved.
Sure.
And then building the panels, I mean, they make beautiful panels. But you'll notice that Samsung has really edged up on Sony.
Absolutely.
For me, I own a Sony, so I'm definitely, just full disclosure, I'm definitely partial to it. What I love is that every 2 weeks I turn on my Sony TV, it's got an update for it, and that's huge. It doesn't give me necessarily new apps, but it makes all the apps that I have on the TV better.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key for me. But yeah, so they're moving away from this. Lenovo is moving into the PC making and the server making things. And clearly there's someone in the world in Japan who believes that they can make money off of these Vio and other brand products. So that's a big piece of this. Meanwhile, Google is selling off hardware services, like hardware makers like Motorola, because they're so focused on software and embedded devices like the Chromecast and the Nest Thermostat and Nest Protect. So it's a very dynamic space. I just know that the Windows machine can't go the way of the Dodo in the very near term because of the amount of times that I'm trying to get stuff done on a non-Windows machine.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. Yeah. You know?
Enterprise as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Enterprise is always going to be a big piece there. But yeah, the embedded devices are fantastic for that quick, got to get something done.
Yeah.
But it is a pain to do certain things on embedded devices, and it continues to be a pain. So there's room in the PC market. Again, let's go back to what you said before, post-PC, Steve Jobs and the word trucks. There are times you need a truck. You need your SUV. You can't get around in your Mini, you know. Your Mini Cooper may go 0 to 60 in 5 seconds, but you can't get around everywhere in that, especially if it's snowing.
Speaking of major companies getting into new areas, Amazon has acquired a gaming studio called Double Helix Games. Irvine-based, California-based company founded in 2007 through the merger of two well-known game development shops, The Collective and Shiny Entertainment. They employ 75 people who will now become Amazon employees and continue to operate in Irvine. Double Helix has a history of creating popular games for nearly 20 years when you consider the work of Shiny and The Collective. Shiny was the creator of classics like Earthworm Jim, Sacrifice, MDK, and Enter the Matrix, and Collective had previously put out titles like Indiana Jones and the Emperor's Tomb, Star Wars 3, Revenge of the Sith, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Double Helix themselves put out Killer Instinct and G.I. Joe Rise of the Cobra, Green Lantern Rise of the Manhunters, Silent Hill Homecoming, and Front Mission Evolved, amongst others. This is Amazon's first foray into their own gaming studio. So this is an interesting move for Amazon.
Bezos is brilliant. So moving into the content creation space has been something he's interested in.
Yeah.
There are new content, original content, TV shows on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
Instant. And let's face it, the gaming industry is as big or bigger than the television and movie industries. So they need to move in this direction in order to better control what's their destiny, you know. So this makes sense. These guys have made fantastic games. The fact that they don't have to move to Seattle is also good news because you want to keep those creative minds where they're most happy.
Sure.
And Amazon gets a foothold in the business. I would have liked to see Amazon buy Steam. I know many people are going to cringe when they hear that, but I feel like if you have a big company that can buy a smaller one, Amazon is the one that lets people do so much of what they need to do and figures out a way to monetize and scale them. You put Amazon servers unabated with Steam's downloadable paradigm, you can't beat it, you know?
I could never see Valve selling themselves. Just because of how Valve is run and you know the way their organization functions, I don't know if I could ever see that.
Surprise, dude! And I'm that when it comes to what Valve does, and when it comes to the sort of like I can expand you and let you, because Valve is ambitious. They want the Steam box. They want all you know. They want the software to be out there. Amazon purchasing Valve would allow Valve to get everything they ever wanted. And just like how they, and their stewardship of Zappos shows that they don't have to subsume you and just eat you up. They can let you be who you want to be with all the resources you need. I think an Amazon purchase makes a lot more sense than the Google Nest purchase in terms of maintaining independence. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I would say that would be true in terms of maintaining independence, but I guess In terms of what Valve has already done, I don't know if they really need anything more. I mean, they are still a private organization, so You know, there isn't very much that we publicly know about them, but it sounds like they are reasonably well off as an independent currently.
Oh, they're doing everything right. It's just like a Nest was doing everything right. But they jumped into Google's arms because that allows them to scale on a crazy fast level. So that's the only thing that's been. With Valve moving forward on the Steam box platform, an Amazon situation will allow them to scale. That's all I'm saying.
Moving on here, action camera company GoPro has filed the initial documents for its initial public offering. According to a press release from them last week, GoPro has seen its sales number for its action camera products and accessories double every year. According to the company, it made over $500 million in gross revenue on the strength of 2.3 million cameras sold in 2012 and racked up over $100 million in sales last January. And its CEO, Nicholas Woodman, hinted that the company might exceed $1 billion in revenue for all of 2013. What I find interesting about this is that the fact that GoPro is deciding to go public is a real testament to the strength of the wearable camera industry.
Well, I mean, you got to understand, they just cornered the market. Last year, their biggest competitor, Contour, which arguably made a better product than GoPro. I'll just put that out there. I mean, they had a product that had...
Okay. Everyone's entitled to their opinion.
It's an opinion, yeah. But when you look at the data, a GoPro camera can connect to your cell phone if you Wi-Fi your cell phone into the camera and thus lock yourself out from any other data coming into your cell phone. You know how ad hoc networks work, right?
Sure.
The Contour would Bluetooth to your camera, and not only would you be able to control it with your phone, you'd be able to see what the camera sees before you film. And this was back in 2011. So they had a device that was far more advanced. For reasons that remain a mystery to most reporters, last year, Contour shut all of its doors. They laid off 60 people, all the people that worked for them, really, and they closed their doors, which meant GoPro was wide open to corner the market, and they have. Sony walked in with a product that is doing okay, but GoPro has experience to move it forward. Another contrast between Contour and GoPro is that GoPro's products are this square form factor, which don't exactly ergonomically or aerodynamically fit with your existing hardware. Contour was a lot sleeker in terms of how it actually dealt with it. A Contour would just sit on the side of a helmet or a goggle or whatever, whereas a GoPro has to be on a stand. Now, that said, GoPro spent most of its money, not most of it, but they spent a significant amount of money making accessories to fit on every single little tiny thing. The Hero 3, which is their current product, suffered from some big hardware firmware problems, which they corrected, and it is going gangbusters. So for $400, you can get a pretty fantastic piece of hardware. Now, we're looking at CES 2014, and everyone's talking about the Internet of Things and wearable technology. Companies like GoPro, Fitbit, Zeal Optics, these guys have been at the forefront of this stuff for years before the mainstream got there. If you're an indie rock person, these are the companies that you liked before these companies got popular. That's really what's going on here. GoPro's like, I'm established now. The mainstream likes me.
Yeah.
I've cornered the market. If you want the top camera, you're going to come to me because I've got 1080p at 60 frames a second. Boom.
Yeah.
And you have to hold your phone up to do it. It's right there. And that's a big deal. So being able to take this product, move it forward, and have the buzz and the PR around the fact that, you're producing something as an American company, that's tight shit. It's also going to allow them to be, it's a little weird because the hostile takeover can show up, but basically IPOing is probably the smartest move for them because they can get an influx of cash and take their product line to the next level. And that's what you really do an IPO for.
Yeah, that'll be exciting to see what else Like, I cannot wait to see how they expand their product line outside of what we already know, outside the little boxy sports.
Focus on a camera. Let's make that clear. They might have an accessory that allows you to, like, control the camera quickly from, mm-hmm. like, a fob or a watch or whatever. Right now, if you have a Pebble, one of the biggest apps is the GoPro Control app, which allows you to use your Pebble to control the play and pause of your GoPro.
I didn't know there was one.
Yeah. It's the first app that I got when I got the new Pebble 2.0. But I will say this. GoPro's strength is focus. Their strength is focusing on making the best wearable camera possible. Mm-hmm. Whether they start embedding that camera into goggles or putting that camera into other things like that, that's one thing. But I do not expect that they will be moving into quote-unquote new product lines right now as much as they will be refining their product line and taking advantage of the fact that they're the only people in the sector with real power so that they can use things like designs from old competitors that fell by the wayside in order to make their products more attractive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty awesome for them and definitely congratulations to the GoPro team. It's also really cool especially for like an organization that lives and breathes their technology, right? It's wearable tech that they, that they use all the time. I remember actually being in the Valley here, we had this Silicon Valley Sports League, which incorporated a lot of the startups and companies around. And one of the teams we faced off in several events was GoPro. And all of them had GoPros on for the various events that we played, Frisbee or Ring Around or, Duck Duck Goose. And it was pretty awesome to be able to check out the footage afterwards. So kind of great to see them. You know, it's always good when organizations dog food their own equipment because it makes it better. And as far as what you said, Dwayne, it's really, even with like Apple and the iPhone, it was just being in the right place at the right time too. That's really part of it. Because there were other contenders before, but the market wasn't really ready. I
disagree with that. Apple and the iPhone, Apple saw smartphones and thought they could do better. GoPro almost invented this market. They have been the leader forever, and they've cornered the market now.
There was wearable tech before GoPro.
Cameras on the level of GoPro, when it first showed up, it was ahead of anything that existed, unlike an Apple iPhone, which was using existing technology, bare bones, to show off a new interface. GoPro showed up, and you could use a phone for a camera. There were mini cameras, but the idea that you had a camera that was going to use flash, a flash card, and record while being attached to like a helmet or whatever, that confluence of technology wasn't really there. GoPro really ran that and really was in charge of that. And people followed them and they couldn't keep up. So it's kind of a testament to like one of the few companies where you can be first and you can still be ahead. Whereas so many companies like Palm, which has fallen by the wayside, or BlackBerry, which has fallen by the wayside, they invented smartphones. They were the first, but they have not survived.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like GoPro is to wearable cameras what Apple was to the smartphone. You know, there were smartphones before. There were, full screen.
Well, I disagree. GoPro invented the wearable camera as a sporting device. Apple did not invent the smartphone. Apple took the smartphone, the MP3 player, all these things, and they made them better. But GoPro really invented the sport wearable camera, the waterproof, wearable, extreme sport camera.
Well, I think I feel like they made it mainstream. I don't necessarily think
they invented it. That's my point. They were not. People were like, what the hell is a GoPro? Why would you spend all this money on a stupid camera?
In the same way, that was before the iPhone too, right?
Right.
Like,
right. There were smartphones before.
That's not what we're talking about, guys. You're saying that Apple and GoPro are the same because Apple broke open the smartphone market. Fine. I get that. There was the Palm Trio. There was the BlackBerry whatever. And Apple changed the game, right?
Sure.
I'm saying GoPro is not that way. GoPro, there were cameras around, DV cameras, whatever cameras, whatever. GoPro said, how about a camera
dedicated to sports? How about a camera that's completely wearable? Those did not exist. The sport wearable camera was something that GoPro ran.
I think there were, because remember in the past, those were, I think they were called like data glasses, but they weren't, I don't think they were as versatile in terms of being able to be as agile. Similar, you know, there were touchscreen devices like the iPhone, but they weren't as...
The capacity of touchscreens with Apple brought, I'm talking about the lightweight, rugged, you know, extreme sports camera was something that GoPro invented. They started that. Nick Woodman began that in 2002. You can't tell me there was a wearable camera in 2002 that was as powerful as the GoPro. I'm saying GoPro invented the market and they've led the market. It is not Apple and the iPhone. Apple took existing phones and made a better product, like how Google took existing mapping technology, like Encarta, and made a better product. It's not the same. It has the same level of prestige in the area, the Apple iPhone, the GoPro camera, level of prestige. But the history of GoPro as an extreme sports guy who spends, you know, tens and tens of days snowboarding a year, I'll tell you, GoPro started this movement. And they rock this movement, and they run this movement. Whereas Apple jumped into the movement of smartphones, reinvented it, and now are a big piece of it. That's the difference, I'm saying.
All right, I'm willing to accept that. Let's move on here, because this next story is huge, and it literally hit us at the last minute before we went to record. And that is that there are reports that Comcast has agreed to acquire Time Warner Cable for about $159 a share in an all-stock deal, combining the largest two U.S. cable companies, according to people familiar with the matter. It has not officially gone down as we speak, but is supposed to be announced tomorrow morning as we're recording this on a Wednesday. So by the time this podcast comes out on Friday, it'll be history. Charter Communications, the fourth largest U.S. company, had offered $132 a share to Time Warner Cable's management, a bid that was rejected. What's interesting about this is, first of all, it's the merging of the top two cable companies in the U.S. By number of subscribers. And Let's just to put this
in. Like AT&T and Verizon deciding they want to get together. That doesn't help anybody but AT&T and Verizon.
Yeah, I mean, let's just put this in perspective. Okay, so Charter, the fourth largest U.S. cable company, has 4 million subscribers. AT&T has 4.5 million. The top two, Comcast and Time Warner. Time Warner has 12 million subscribers. That is three times the amount of Charter. Comcast has nearly double Time Warner's at 22 million subscribers. Between Comcast and Time Warner, after this merger is done, they're going to have 34 million subscribers. They're completely going to eclipse the number three and four, anybody else on the map.
It's a call monopoly, guys. Yeah. And frankly, if anyone has ever dealt with either of these two companies, you can just understand how customer service is going to fall through the tubes. Yes. Get together.
Remember, what was it? Comcast, their customer service was notoriously so bad that they had to create basically a specialist Comcast Cares Twitter account just to sort of counteract the bad press that they've been getting about their customer service.
Yeah, and I mean, not sure how much it's helped.
I mean, I gotta say, like, I can't get on Facebook for a week without seeing someone complain about Time Warner or Comcast. Mm-hmm. I'm a Comcast customer. For a brief time, I was a Time Warner customer in New York. I've been a Optimum Cablevision customer. No one's great here, and part of it might be the fact that they have to serve so many people with this service that's basically magic. It's magic. You're getting connectivity into your home at crazy speeds. It is magic. But I just don't see how this affects the consumer in a positive way. I just see them cornering a market and dictating terms. As it stands, I don't know how my internet bill went from $59 a month to $79 a month over the course of a year without me really knowing. Right? Like, this kind of creep happens all the time, and we're just supposed to expect them to deal with it. It's like a running commentary, water cooler chatter to complain about Comcast and Time Warner.
You know what I'm actually sort of curious about is how is it internationally? Because internationally, you know, speeds are better, but like, do they see the same sort of struggles with their companies
out there? And also, like, so if you go to England, or let's go to Australia, right? Like, Telcel is the company, and people hate Telcel, but it is the company, and people hate it, and you get better speeds. There are other countries where it's state sponsored. The big difference is that Comcast and Time Warner and whoever and Optimum, whoever else, they will work with the government on request to give data to the government about what you've been doing. In every other country, that's just the default. I'm going to give the government data on what you've been doing.
Right.
That's like kind of like the only difference. Everyone hates every cable service provider, every TV service provider. We have more choice. We have more content. And we have some level of rights when it comes to our privacy. So internationally, they may get better speeds, but they get none of the awesome Americanness.
It doesn't have to be that way. I hope Google Fiber produces a better experience.
I mean, Google Fiber, I'm wondering if Google Fiber is a lot like Al Sharpton running for president. He's never going to win, but he brings up the kind of issues that make everybody else have to talk about them and come to a position on them, right?
Uh-huh.
Google Fiber shows up. I'm in, you know, Kansas City. I'm doing really well. And suddenly, like, Fios redoubles its efforts. Or, you know, AT&T is showing up with fiber. Because, man, Google's doing it. I got to get in front of Google. I don't know if Google's strategy is to actually, like, provide fiber with everybody as much as it is to get people to move forward. Remember with Spectrum, Google was going to buy Spectrum. And it eventually let Verizon buy it because Verizon promised that anything, any connected devices on that Spectrum. Mm-hmm. So it's just unclear to me. Let's not forget that if Comcast buys Time Warner, it's not only this whole customer service situation, whatever. It's a content thing. Comcast just bought NBC and everything associated with it. If Comcast buys Time Warner, they effectively own all of HBO, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Time Warner. So they own the pipes and they own the content. And that's really one of the big things that's happening here. We've talked about the dumb pipe cable provider. And the fact that they can own the content, too, is a huge deal. So, you know, everything you know of HBO, that will now be under the thumb of Comcast. And that also means that just like how you haven't been able to get HBO Go as a standalone subscription, it will continue to not be a standalone subscription because Comcast will want to tie that in with other services and not allow that to kind of function as its own product, really.
Let's maybe we should summarize the collective intellectual properties that will be in this new merger. So we're talking about HBO, Warner Brothers, Turner, Time Inc., and on the Comcast side, NBC, Universal, and of course the everything else that belongs to Comcast.
Yeah, I mean they'll become a company that will probably go to the Justice Department and say, "Hey, look, we're trying to rival Disney here, which owns ABC, yeah. ESPN, and also obviously in Marvel and Star Wars. We're trying to rival them. We are the antithesis to Disney." And that's who we're competing against in this space, and that's how they're gonna try to get around the Justice Department. But the fact is, they're gonna move from being a giant company to like a supersized Korean chobo company. Think Samsung making your microwave and your car.
Sure, sure, sure. I have a question for you guys. How is this effective monopoly going to affect legislation about cable services in the future, cable and television and internet ISP services in the future?
I think negatively, but I guess before that happens, I'm hopefully skeptical that this is going to go through. And maybe it's just me being naive.
What does it mean to be hopefully skeptical? You do not think it's going to go through, or you hope that it's not going to go through, or what does that mean?
I think it means that I hope that it's not going to go through.
Okay. I think I'm in agreement there. I don't see the benefit for the consumer if, you know, 60, 70% of all the people connected to broadband via cable or connected to TV are going through the same company. That doesn't seem to me to be
benefit. Sounds sort of like a monopoly.
Yeah.
And of course, as we know, competition breeds innovation. So
Yeah. I feel like innovation really will be stifled if this goes through. And I think the only thing that could possibly stop this from going through is intervention from the government, anti-monopoly intervention.
Yeah. Antitrust kind of stuff. Yeah.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called The Martian by Andy Weir. This is one of those interesting sort of like locked room mysteries or something akin to Castaway, I would say. And basically, the synopsis is this. Astronaut Mark Watney became one of the first people to walk on Mars. Now he's sure to be the first person to die there after a dust storm nearly kills him and forces his crew to evacuate while thinking him dead. Mark finds himself stranded and completely alone with no way even to signal Earth that he's alive. And even if he could get word out, his supplies would be gone long before a rescue could arrive. But Mark isn't ready to give up yet. Drawing on his ingenuity, his engineering skills, and a relentless, dogged refusal to quit, he steadfastly confronts one seemingly insurmountable obstacle after the next. This sounds like ready for feature film.
I'm against the characterization of this book is ready for a feature film.
I know your point of view is it should stand alone as a book. We shouldn't even.
No, that's not my point of view at all. I think when you have a robust piece of literature like this, you know, Audible is a fantastic way to appreciate the content. But if it's going to move to a screen, it's better than it moves to a small screen and focuses on a mini series or elongated series type situation rather than trying to be compacted into 2 hours of film on the big screen. I think Game of Thrones is a fantastic interpretation of a book, and that's granted it's a series of books, but they treated each book like its own season for the most part. And taking a book like this and throwing, you know, man against nature, really, this is a classic theme, throwing this against a 10-episode series, Band of Brothers kind of thing, with a budget, that to me is how to express it on the screen, not as the big budget movie feature that's 2 hours with no context as we experience with World War Z.
All I know is that my wife's already read this. She says it's amazing. It's next up on my queue of things to read. It does definitely have that sort of gravity vibe to me, just the description alone. So there you go. That's one choice that you could make with Audible's trial, The Martian by Andy Weir. To download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. It helps us on our show when you use that URL. And also you get the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. So, okay, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, why Flappy Bird had to die. Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuaken. Hours before the 2014 Winter Olympics opening ceremony was set to kick off, Google put some of its most valuable real estate, their logo, to good use to show their support for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Olympians on their way to Sochi. The standard logo was replaced with a rainbow of color with each hue silhouetted by a winter sport athlete. This is significant because LGBT rights with regards to the Olympics in Russia has been a concern for quite some time, particularly after the Russian government enacted a law banning the distribution of any material on the topic of gay rights, and homophobic violence in the region had surged. So the International Olympic Committee went back and forth on whether or not Olympians were allowed to express themselves on the matter while in Sochi.
This is strange because the whole point of the Olympics is to drop politics and just have sport.
Sure.
And
sure.
That way we bring culture together.
Sure.
Now, there's no secret that, you know, you will have homosexual athletes at the Olympics. Russia's new law basically stops homosexual propaganda. You can't tell children. It's illegal to tell children that homosexual love is as good as straight love. Mm-hmm. You can't basically be out and open without someone saying that you're not spreading homosexual propaganda. The penalty seems severe, but really what they're trying to do is suppress people from coming out of the closet. And it's one of those things that comes along with Putin trying to focus on being a conservative and nationalist leader. Mm-hmm. He left the presidency, went into the prime minister situation. Chechnya blew up. These terrorists blew up. And he wanted to create a nationalist conservative culture. If you look at the Olympic ceremonies, he's brought back the Cossacks, people who were removed by the Soviets before Putin. Right. Because they were too individualized as a culture. They weren't just straight up Russian. Putin has tried to bring back these cultural conservative traditions in order to nationalize Russia in a way that you might think of China when China says, hey, look, people should be followed on the internet, or like Taiwan is part of China. We should destroy Taiwan if they want to walk away. He wants that level of loyalty coming out of the Russian populace. And he thinks that using homosexuals as an attack and using it as a way to distance himself from the West is something that's going to help him domestically. It's something that'll help him when it comes to China and so on. So they've moved in this direction. Now, it's become a problem because essentially there are now people blackmailing other people. A gay couple with a kid is getting blackmailed, according to KCRW's Warren Olney, because they can't tell their child. Their neighbors are basically saying, you can't tell your child that you have a love as strong as ours because we're heterosexual, or else we'll tell the authorities. So there's some negative consequences going on. And the fact that Google showed up with its international presence and said, you know what, we're going to respectfully show off our logo regarding the Olympics. Right. We're also going to respectfully, tastefully, and subtly lay out our support for gay rights via their symbol of the rainbow. Is an interesting way for a tech company to get involved in something.
That's what I love the most about this, is how tasteful and subtle they were. They weren't overt. Beneath the logo, they had a quote from the Olympic Charter, which read, every individual must have the possibility of practicing sport without discrimination of any kind and in the Olympic spirit. Which, you know, there was nothing overt about it, and they just sort of made their stand in the most tasteful, as you said, and subtle way. So my hat off to Google. You have to admire how well they did it without making it a overtly political statement.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I feel an admiration for it or respect for it in terms of like what they're trying to do, as much as the fact that it's interesting to me that they're addressing the situation. Clearly, Google thinks it is in their best economic interest to support the LGBT community across the world. And maybe that's a situation tied to their dedication to openness and freedom. But as I look at it from a sort of reporting angle, it was an interesting decision to make and a bold one.
Sure.
And obviously, you have to give them respect for that. There's no doubt.
But they didn't have to do anything at all.
Yeah, they didn't have to do anything at all. Russia could cut them off at any time, the way China is focused on Baidu.
Exactly.
So it's a very interesting and it's an interesting move. Is it selfless or is it calculated? That's the question we have to put forward. Or even a third question, does it matter? Mm-hmm. It's clear that, at least in this country, LGBT rights are moving toward the arc of history at a pace much faster than African-descended, Asian-descended, or Latin-right-descended things ever happened. So from a perspective of like access and freedom, it's huge. Google's obviously based in San Francisco, the Mountain View area, which is also culturally very friendly to homosexuals.
Sure.
So it's an interesting, fascinating, and a move that I want to continue to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Because companies in the old school do not get involved in politics when they can avoid getting involved in politics. So that's
right.
Something that's pretty interesting to watch.
Moving on here, sources familiar with Microsoft's plans tell The Verge that the company is seriously considering allowing Android apps to run on both Windows and Windows Phone. While planning is ongoing and is still early, reports that some inside Microsoft favor the idea of simply enabling Android apps inside its Windows and Windows Phone stores, while others believe it could lead to the death of the Windows platform altogether. Why would Microsoft want to do any of this? The Verge's Tom Warren asks. While Microsoft has been trying every trick to convince developers to build for Windows Phone and Windows, it has to answer to the mobile reality the company faces, which is embracing Android and extending it to the Windows and Windows Phone app stores could help Microsoft temporarily in the app race, but it might also stem the flow of consumers choosing Android and iOS-based smartphones and tablets.
Guys, yeah, this seems like one of the first big decisions that their new CEO is going to have to face here is mm-hmm. what to do with this device and what to do with this sort of ecosystem.
Yeah, but this question has shown up before. We saw this before, guys. Don't you remember when we saw this before?
I vaguely recall Google doing restrictions on some of the apps that could run. And was it via mail?
No, it was when BlackBerry came out with their BlackBerry tablet. They and BlackBerry and the OS that ran on that, they had intended to virtualize Android apps in order to get more adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Get those BlackBerry-loving people to get your tablet, and you already have several hundred thousand apps because you're running Android apps already. That did not do well. The playbook failed unequivocally. Why? Because developers were not creating apps that were native to that platform. Every platform has a different culture, a different interface language and standards. That's why the Android version of Instagram and the iOS version of Instagram are totally different, because it's a different experience. Windows supporting Android apps is ridiculous when Windows has the money, Microsoft has the money, to recruit, you know, Android developers, developers period, developers who develop across mobile platforms. They have the money to recruit them, to build for them. It is there, and it's possible, and it will help their international business, you know, in a crazy way, because that's where they're selling the most amount of phones. This is a strange and desperate idea.
You don't think this is a good, this is a good move for Microsoft?
This is a bad business move. This is a bad, like, you, Windows Phone is not, it's very far away from a shitty operating system. There are things they have to do to make it more short, to shore it up and make it more sexy. They have to make it so that when they, like the whole Windows 7, Windows 8 fiasco with the Nokia Lumia, you know, you buy the top of the line phone and it can't use the next operating system. That's something they need to fix. They need to look at the best of breed, figure out what makes them the best of breed, and do what Microsoft's always done, and emulate it and expand upon it and make it better. Microsoft took the browser. Microsoft took the desktop operating system. They've looked at the way that other people did them. They've, you know, taken pieces or they've remixed those things in a very popular, super friendly ways. Windows Phone is no different. It's fantastic in terms of the interface, at least. New, fresh, vibrant. People have moved toward the flat interface on both Android and iOS because of Windows Phone. So for them to say, we're just going to go with Android because it's the easier thing in the short term, that's weird. It's not powerful.
It's like an admission of a lack of confidence in the platform.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft needs to take their Xbox money and sink it into Windows, Windows Phone. That's what they need to do. As the Xbox One continues to grow, they need to sink that cash into the online situation and get developers there. Suck them in by saying, if you build an app for Windows, we'll subsidize the building of your app for Windows Phone and for Xbox. They need to get into that mentality. And it's sad to think that they can even imagine emulating Google apps on their phones. Can you imagine the battery that that takes up? Ugh.
Oh, yeah, anytime you do any sort of emulation, any sort of virtualization, it's fairly processor intensive.
And it's a crappy experience because of the lag and everything. It's just, it's just, it's foolish. This is a foolish, foolish move.
Yeah, I don't really, you know, thinking about it a little bit more, it doesn't make sense ultimately, because what is the true value proposition that you're giving someone that, oh, they can run Android apps on their Windows Phone? It really, in emulated mode, it seems like, at that case, why not just get yourself an Android device where you can run it natively, right? The experience just won't be as good as an Android device where you can run it natively, and I think it would push more people to just get those devices. I'm not sure it's the best really move. And I do agree with you, Dwayne. Like, there may be some short-term benefit in spurring maybe some purchases that you may not have had before, but the long-term implications I don't think are very positive or even necessary.
Yeah, it's just... I hope it's a rumor. Let's just put it that way.
Well, I'm sure we'll find out shortly. With it, sometime between now and next week, we'll know for sure. The New York Times reports that intelligence officials investigating how Edward Snowden gained access to a huge trove of the country's most classified documents say they've determined that he used inexpensive and widely available software to scrape the NSA's networks and kept at it even after he was challenged by agency officials. using web crawler software designed to search, index, and back up a website. Snowden scraped data out of our systems, they say, while he went about his day job, according to senior intelligence official. He says that we don't believe this was an individual sitting in a machine and downloading this much material in sequence. The process was quite automated, he thinks. The findings are striking because the NSA's mission includes protecting the nation's most sensitive military and intelligence computer systems from cyber attacks, especially the sophisticated attacks that emanate from Russia and China. Snowden's insider attack, by contrast, was hardly sophisticated and should have been easily detected, investigators found. A web crawler, also called the Spider, automatically moves from website to website following links embedded in each document and can be programmed to copy everything in its path. Snowden appears to have set the parameters for the searches, including which subjects to look for and how deeply to follow links and documents to other data on the NSA's internal networks. It wasn't a very difficult task for him at all, and it seems like it's the kind of thing that the NSA should have spotted fairly easily. You know, that's sort of like a sign of it's not a very good sign for a company that an organization that prides itself on being the state of the art in intelligence gathering.
We could probably say the same thing about a lot of our other industries as well, too, if you think about it in terms of what you've seen with healthcare and what you've seen all across, where a lot of the times places with such high level of technology are still very backwards in sort of the operating status. So it's a sad reality, I guess, is what we can say. And hopefully times will change, things will improve, and people will realize the importance of you know, infrastructure and security behind it.
I think it's fascinating that compared to the types of revelations that we've seen come out of the Snowden documents, and how cutting edge and invasive those were, that the NSA could not protect themselves from simple web crawling spiders. All right, let's move on here. Okay, so this was somehow the biggest story of the week, and it's the story that just would not die because of how it died, essentially, and that is about Flappy Bird. Have either of you guys played Flappy Bird at all?
I played, I think it was like Flappy Doge. Uh-huh. Did you see that? I played that one on the web for a couple minutes, but I heard a lot about Flappy Bird at the office, as it was definitely brought up by our CEO on a few occasions.
Was he hooked on Flappy Bird?
Yeah, he mentioned Flappy Bird, and then he during a meeting we had, and then he also wondered how many people were playing and who had the highest score in the room.
So a little background here, and this comes from a Slate magazine. Will Oremus is the author here. Over the past weekend, 29-year-old Vietnamese game designer Dong Nguyen removed Flappy Bird from app stores after tweeting, "I cannot take this anymore." The 50 million people who had already downloaded the improbable smash hit can still play it on their phones, but the rest of the world's billions will never know the exquisite frustration of fatally bonking Flappy's pixelated yellow head on a pixelated green pipe. The history behind this is really interesting. It was obscure when it was first launched last May, and it soared to fame over the winter for reasons that remain unclear. Some people have speculated that Dong Nguyen had artificially boosted the comments in the iTunes App Store, increasing its presence, but by the first week in February, it achieved heights previously touched only by Candy Crush and Angry Birds. Not only was Flappy Bird by far the number one free app on both the iPhone and Android app app stores, but blatant ripoffs like Flappy Plane, Fly Birdie, Iron Pants, and then you mentioned Flappy Doge were in the top 50 as well. Nguyen, the game's creator, said he coded it over the course of a few nights after coming home from work. By last week, he told The Verge that he was raking in $50,000 a day in ad revenue. And if you haven't played this game, and I have not, it's like a super simplistic game. Basically, it's you tap the screen repeatedly in order to pilot little Flappy Bird through gaps between a series of pipes that look like they came from Super Mario Brothers. If you touch one of the pipes, the bird drops dead, and that's it. Game over. No bad guys, no power-ups, no levels, no changes of scenery. It sounds easy until you try it. Unless you're marvelously gifted, you're likely to smack into the first pipe at least a dozen times before you achieve even the modest score of one. You can waste weeks without topping 25. Quoting Will Oramus again here in Slate, he says, "To devote oneself to Flappy Bird is to know the abject futility of Sisyphus." So it's kind of a mystery why this disappeared, why the creator, Dong Nguyen, decided to remove it from the stores. He told Forbes in an exclusive interview that Flappy Bird was designed to play in a few minutes when you're relaxed, but it happened to become an addictive product. He says, "I think it has become a problem. To solve that problem, it's best to take down Flappy Bird. Gone forever." Nguyen has several other top App Store games, including Super Ball Juggling and Shuriken Block. He says that there's no plans to remove those games, which he termed as harmless. If he thought users were getting addicted, however, he said he wouldn't hesitate also to take those down. In mulling whether to pull Flappy Bird, Nguyen said that it was guilt atop the fact that, quote, "my life has not been as comfortable as I was before" that motivated him. "I couldn't sleep," he said. He added that his conscience is relieved. He spent the last few days internet-free catching up on slumber. He says, "I don't think it's a mistake." He says, "I thought it through." He says he'll continue to develop games. He says, "After the success of Flappy Bird, I feel more confident. I have freedom to do what I want to do." He also said that he won't take any legal action against any of the copycats. He says he tried playing Iron Pants. It's a good game. So, I mean, the short life and death of a number one app game on the app on both Android and iOS app stores, it's pretty amazing sort of sensation that swept the nation. I also want to mention that there's a couple of really good articles about this. One of them was the aforementioned Will Oramus article in Slate. And there's an article by Ian Bogost in The Atlantic called, I think it's called Why Flappy Bird. No, I'm sorry. The Squalid Grace of Flappy Bird. And it sort of deconstructs the obsession with Flappy Bird as a comment on existentialism. And it seems like improbable, but it's a really fascinating article, and I highly recommend that. I'm going to link to that in the show notes. Any thoughts on Flappy Bird from either of you?
It's a really interesting phenomenon. I'm still very intrigued about why it was removed. I've seen a lot of different rumors, like Nintendo gave him a warning letter because of some of the, you know, a lot of the content within Flappy Bird is not unique to that game. Even things like Apple giving a warning, but it's interesting that it sounds like it wrecked his life, but it also sounded like he's still doing interviews. So I'm not sure, you know, right, what sort of press. It's a really odd story. And it really seemingly came out of nowhere. But then what am I to judge? You know, Dogecoin is a thing and people mine for it. So who knows?
It's easy. It's been easy to make these Flappy Bird ripoffs because the game mechanics are so simple. But I guess there will never be another original Flappy Bird.
Better yet, just buy Broken Age and go play that instead.
There you go.
Some other game.
It's good advice. All right, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, what's it like to fall thousands of feet to the ground without a parachute? We'll show you in our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuwakan. And let's talk about our Drill Down video of the week here. This was a pretty amazing video. And what it is a footage from a GoPro camera that came off of a skydiver. Apparently the GoPro was discovered on property that belongs to someone who was apparently a farmer, because what had happened was the GoPro fell off the helmet of the skydiver as they were about to dive and fell thousands of feet from the sky into a pig pen, where it almost immediately was picked up by the pig in the pig pen, and the pig started chewing on it. It's pretty amazing video, because it's basically a first person view of what it's like to fall from the sky without a parachute and land in a pigsty.
Yeah, pretty ridiculous. And it's really distorted, so it's really a weird sort of visualization until it goes plop into the ground, and really kind of amazing that that they were able to find that afterwards, or at least this individual who owned the grounds were able to find it and post it. I'm very curious if there was any other sort of details to kind of tell who the owner was, and maybe they'll somehow meet up in the end. But makes you wonder, or at least makes me wonder, you know, each time I'm close to an edge and very, you know, curious about making sure I don't drop my keys or anything valuable.
Yeah, according to the YouTube, the about section in the YouTube entry for this, there wasn't any identifying information about who the skydiver was or where it came from. The person who discovered it put the video online, and they discovered it apparently in their backyard. And I guess what was going on in the video, you see the camera leaving the plane that the skydiver was in, presumably falling off of the helmet of the skydiver. And then you see the landscape start to spin rapidly, and I'm guessing that is the camera itself spinning through the air. And at one point, it spins at a rate that matches up with the frames per second that the camera is actually recording at. And so what you get is like this steady view of the sky and the horizon, but because it's spinning, it's steady and distorted in this really sort of weird, sort of psychedelic way. And then boom, it hits the ground, and then it's pointed up when it hits the ground, and all you see is a pig sort of POV, like right in front of the camera, come in and start chewing on it first. And you can almost see like the look of bewilderment on the pig's face. Like, what is this thing? What is this gift that has fallen from the sky? But cool video. It's probably the one of the most interesting videos I've seen of the week. So let's wrap it up here, and I'm going to go around the table here. Start with you, Dwayne. Let me ask you, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always hit me up at Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, and you can check me out at flavors.me/DwayneD. Dwayne D is spelled D-W-A-Y-N-E-D.
Tosin, where can we find your work when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find other work at ircwebcast.blogspot.com and my R2D2 build at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
That is a fascinating blog, by the way. I'm always interested in what new sort of component of the R2D2 build that you've put up. This week you put up like the little LED lights that go inside like one of his little sections there. And I thought it was fascinating how it's like this regular size LED panel, but it's got this standoff part where it's got the LEDs connected by way of fiber optic, mini fiber optic cables, short lengths of fiber optic cables. So they go down to a much smaller sort of panel size to fit the actual R2D2 panel slot that those go into.
Yeah, no, there's some impressive stuff that people have been able to do, and I have another update coming up soon about my paint room, as well as this weekend I get to go to a hobby expo, so hopefully get to actually see a lot of cool things, but also meet up with some other R2 builders and see their R2, their fully automated R2s up close and personal.
Oh, take lots of pictures.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Cool. All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook at MrBabyMan. And you can just do a Google search for MrBabyMan. You'll find all my social media links there. As for the show, you can if you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.